we go. Okay. Just needed a little extra attention.
Okay, right, so we're recording at table three. I am Alex Lichtenstein. I am a professor of history and American studies at Indiana University in Bloomington, so know very little about Indianapolis and hope to learn. And I'm one of the curators of the Unmasked exhibit now at the Christmas Attucks Museum.
Terry Jett. I'm a professor of political science, peace and conflict studies, and the faculty director of the Hub for Black Affairs and Community Engagement at Butler University.
My name is Glenn North. I am from Kansas City, Missouri. I am the director of inclusive learning and creative impact at the Kansas City Museum. I'm an adjunct professor at Rutgers University, and I am also a poet.
I am Robert Chester, curator of the Christmas Attucks Museum, also serve as the digital archivist, licensed ordained minister, doctor of theology, and a few other things.
All right, here we go. I'm going to turn over one of the cards. Ooh, what monuments are in your neighborhood? Whose history do they represent? And we can also talk about Kansas City as well as Indianapolis. As Glenn and I have been discussing over the last 24 hours, there are a lot of interesting parallels.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, being here at the Christmas Attucks Museum, located on historic Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Street, the school is an icon of the Black community. The neighborhood is, along with Lockfield Gardens, the first all-Black housing project in Indiana, which is few hundred yards from here. It represents the Black community, the Black struggle, the Black challenges, the Black overcoming, and the triumph that we are now experiencing, and what is to come in our recent future and our distant future.
Well, I live in a fairly rural part of Indianapolis, so there's no monuments there, but I do know that we have one of the most war memorials in the country. I think we are second or third for having monuments that celebrate, I guess I would say the military, but war in particular, which I found fascinating. And I'm originally from California, so moving here to a place that is, I would suggest, so hyper-patriotic was a fascinating experience for me. And also the American Legion headquarters is also based here, so I think that it is definitely in alignment with that. And also representational just in a lot of the border challenges, I would suggest, with Indiana in particular. Because Southern Indiana seems to be more Southern-like than moving further central and north.
So in my neighborhood in Kansas City, there aren't any monuments. But if we talk about the greater Kansas City area, the big discussion that's taking place right now is actually the removal of the Andrew Jackson statue in front of City Hall. At the Kansas City Museum, we just had a meeting with one of the city council people who's interested in having that removed and figuring out what the best process is so that it's not, obviously it's a controversial issue, but to do it with as little fallout as
possible. So why is there an Andrew Jackson statue in front of the city? Because last time I checked, y'all don't live in Tennessee.
Yeah, no. So Missouri was a slave state. We
were Confederate.
Aligned with the South.
Mm-hmm.
So
was Indiana.
Jackson County. Mm-hmm. So, Andrew Jackson was a huge influence on Kansas Cityans who lived during that time, right? After the murder of George Floyd and the conversation around memorials and what should be done, it's really been interesting. Right after George Floyd got murdered, we have an area in Kansas City, the Plaza, which is noted for being the first outdoor mall. It was geared towards cars and Kansas City becoming kind of a car town. And J.C. Nichols, who is one of Kansas City's, very instrumental in how Kansas City evolved, but he was just masterful in terms of redlining and creating the suburbs and instigating white flight. and had real estate codes that excluded black people and Jewish people. Well, he built the plaza. And so the plaza has become kind of the place where whenever there's a big protest, people gather around the J.C. Nichols Fountain in Kansas City. And I was working for the Parks Department at the time, a small black cultural institution. And the protesters felt that it's really ironic, if that's the right word, that we're talking about all of these very, you know, tense racial issues in front of the J.C. Nichols Fountain. And so one of our Parks Board members began a movement to remove the name from the fountain, which is really interesting because his descendants still live in Kansas City.
Oh, wow.
And very powerful.
Yeah.
But they were able to get his name removed from the fountain. And then just really quickly, working with the Community Remembrance Project of Missouri, we were able to get a historical marker erected in Case Park, which is the site where, it wasn't Case Park then, but where a gentleman named Levi Harrington was lynched in 1882, falsely accused of shooting a police officer. So we were successful in getting that historical marker erected. It's been vandalized, it's been sawed off and thrown over.
And this is how we found Glenn as someone to be involved in the advisory board of our exhibit, because we knew you had been instrumental in that. So, I mean, in fact, Glenn and I were talking, so Glenn was telling me about a place in Kansas City called Kessler Park. I said, well, Kessler, who's that dude? He said, oh, he was one of these city architects, part of the City Beautiful movement, who was also instrumental in segregating urban areas. And I said, that's interesting. Indianapolis has a Kessler Boulevard. I wonder if it's named after the same guy. Guess what? Lo and behold.
Wow.
We Googled it. Same dude.
Wow.
So there's a direct connection between the City Beautiful movement, Kansas City, Indianapolis, and segregated urban space in the early 20th century. So I was struck, you know, as Terry was pointing out, you know, Indianapolis is known as the City of Monuments. I think that's one of its, you know, nicknames.
Yeah.
I'm not from Indianapolis. I live in Bloomington, 60 miles to the south, but I come up here a lot now. And yesterday, I went on a, yesterday meaning October 20th, I went on a walking tour led by a guy named Samson Levingston.
Yes,
I think his name
I'm
is,
familiar with his work.
Of Indiana Avenue, as Robert Chester was saying, sort of the famous, now rather, you know, desolated strip, which was the heart of the black commercial and cultural area here. And Samson pointed out all these monuments, buildings, memorial signs, a monument to the jazz musicians who were absolutely crucial to the sort of the cultural efflorescence here. That monument to the jazz musicians, which is on the corner of Indiana Avenue and West Street, if I have this right, I've driven past that over the past year, coming up to the Attucks Museum, at least 30 times. I've never seen it. I never noticed it. And Samson kept saying, the only way you're going to see certain monuments, particularly the ones to African-American life, is if you get out of your car and start walking around. And he was so totally right. So one of the things I keep thinking about, and I'm very interested in monuments, is there are lots of monuments, sometimes not even noted or marked.
Right.
But if you walk around your neighborhood, or if you start asking people who live in the neighborhood, there are monuments, right? They're just not the ones that are sort of put in the middle of the circle
right,
where everyone has to see them. I'll
yes,
bet you, Terry, there are even monuments in your neighborhood that you might not know of.
I don't think so. I am literally in a very rural, like the most rural zip code in Indianapolis.
Yeah,
so I'm near Eagle Creek Park. And so it's fairly protected
right
there. But I think the question is also posing, you know, how does that reflect the culture of the community?
Yeah.
And, you know, how do people feel about, you know, a particular monument? And people have lived with these symbols for so long and maybe ignored them, or just maybe it was a reminder of where they lived. And so sometimes I think about that also when I go to, you know, different places in Indiana, but I'm like, okay, I'm reminded.
So what's the most, I mean, Glenn, you said very nicely, right, that this Nichols thing, the Nichols Fountain, people found understandably offensive. So what's the most offensive monument from your perspective, Terry, in Indianapolis? Like, if you go to your students, you say, all right, I really want to show you something that actually deserves to be torn down. or remarked. Is there one?
I haven't seen one myself, but you know, I haven't been all throughout Indiana. So there could be some in some other locations that I just haven't gone. I will say that when I first moved to Indianapolis and I was teaching a class, just intro to U.S. politics class of Butler students, and I asked them to tell me about Indiana. And my class was predominantly white, actually all white. And they said to me, do not go to communities that end in Ville or Woods. And so therefore my 20 plus years here, I have not gone to a lot of different, you know, communities just because the way they said that, and of course they pointed out Martinsville in
That's
particular.
What they're thinking of.
They were thinking about Martinsville.
The discussion of Bloomington. Martinsville, since this is being taped, is a small community,
yes,
halfway between Indianapolis, the city's, you know, the state's biggest city, and Bloomington, which is, you know, where the flagship campus is located, the State University. Both
right.
Blue areas and everything in between, deep, deep red. And Martinsville, I guess, is notorious for being the hometown.
Yes,
of,
where Carol Jenkins, a young African-American woman, was killed in 64.
That.
And there was just a film done by, oh, I'm going to die because I am forgetting the name of the woman who just did the film. Because her case was, she was killed by the Klan.
So wait, and this is something I didn't know, Terry. So in 19, because
64,
Martinsville is notorious for being the Klan headquarters back in the 1920s. Because that's where D.C. Stevenson, the head of the Klan, which ran the state in the 1920s,
yes,
lived. But there's a 1964 story, too?
Yeah, it was
that.
A
Sorry.
Young black woman
Carol
that was
Jenkins.
Jenkins. That, and there's just a documentary was just done by... come up with a name in just a minute, and where she was selling encyclopedias, and you know, she was dropped off there in Martinsville with one other young black woman who actually was very fair skinned, and so they didn't know that she was also black, but they ended up being separated. But anyway, Carol ended up being killed, and her case was they caught one of the person, but her case was like reopened as part of the Emmett Till legislation that just
I had no
came
idea.
Out.
So is there a memorial to her? Is the question.
There is now in Roseville. I believe there's a park.
But it's also
named
a Ville.
After because that's where she's from. Yes.
But there's nothing
also
in
Ville.
Martinsville.
They had some sort of gathering or something, but there's nothing in Martinsville. And I was told, like, gas up before you go to Bloomington. And do not stop in Martinsville.
Right. I mean, I've heard this from black colleagues.
And that's why.
In Bloomington, who live up in Indy and commute to Bloomington.
Yes.
And they always say, I try not to drive through that area after dark. One of my colleagues, black colleagues, once got a flat tire in that area.
Yes.
Very, very nervous, understandably. But I hadn't heard the Carol Jenkins story, so I'm going to go look that up. But also, I hadn't heard this other sort of, I don't want to call it folklore because that's dismissive because this contains a lot of truth in it. But this, so don't go to anywhere that ends in
Ville or Woods.
Or Woods.
That's what they said, yes.
Wow,
and
I've not heard that.
You know, there's Zionsville, Shelbyville.
There are a lot of Villes.
Noblesville,
yep.
Crawfordsville. I mean, there's a
that's
lot.
A long list. Right.
And so when you're black and you're new to a community and you have, you know, young white people telling you this, you pay attention. So, yeah, so I said all that to say there could be some memorials. I haven't seen them.
Right.
I haven't gone to the locations where they would
exist. Right. Shall we move on to another? Or, I mean, I'm deeply interested in these questions of memorials.
Yes, I have to.
You guys might know.
We can move to another
question.
I'm going to get the name of the... All right. I don't know why I'm forgetting her name.
You
okay.
Pick one.
Yeah, we'll take turns here. What forms of self-segregation exist today? So first of all, we have to define the term, right?
Oh.
Self-segregation.
Oh, wow.
Is that when I choose to separate myself from someone who doesn't look like me? Or?
Yes. Actually, the person is Sandra Chapman. That's who did the did the documentary. I don't know what her name was. I finished it, but South Central Gangish, and I don't know if I would you know, that's really a challenging concept, because are we talking about doing it by choice? For what reason? You know, like, is it for you know, safety, you know, protection? You know, that's how I would sort of think of it. And I don't know if I would even say, like, segregation, because it could be that you're just trying to connect with, you know, people that you relate to, you know, that are just more like you and your family, or... but it doesn't mean that you're isolating yourself necessarily. And so it would be like, well, what in what context? You know, are we talking about the lunchroom? You know, I mean, that's where it comes up a lot. And they always say, why are the black kids sitting, you know, together? Well, they're in a predominantly white space. And so they're just trying to make some sort of familiar connection to probably release, just to let down a little bit. And so... but there's never the, you know, why are the white students, doing that?
I was just going to say, Cherry, thank you for that. And you're right on the money. I just wanted to look it up, just since we are recording.
Look up self-segregation. Yeah,
yes.
So it says self-segregation or auto-segregation, the separation of a religious, ethnic, or racial group from other groups in a country by the group itself naturally. This usually results in decreased social interactions between different ethnic, racial, or religious groups and can be classed as a form of social exclusion. So that's what Google tells us.
So if I go to synagogue, that, which I don't anyway, but you know, since I'm Jewish, if I go to synagogue or send my kids to Jewish school, is that social exclusion or is that, right, that would be...
I mean, I wouldn't see it that way.
One of the things that I think a lot of white folks have a hard time understanding, like, let's take this event. The people's table, the morning event, is multiracial. The afternoon event, the artist table, is actually for black artists or people who self-identify as black. That doesn't count Rachel Donazal, but everyone else. So, so a lot of white people are like, but I don't understand. I thought you black folks wanted integration, and now you're telling me I can't sit at the table with you, you know, in the afternoon. I understand that. I'm not uncomfortable with that. I recognize what you're saying, Terry, which is that sometimes black people have to protect themselves and speak to just themselves, because that's just the way, you know, that's the way Jews do it too sometimes, even though we might not admit it. So, but I think a lot of white people have a hard time wrapping their head around that, unfortunately.
Yes.
No, I was just going to say, I have a friend who I'm always inviting to go places and they don't come, and then when I don't, then they get mad. And I said, so she said, well, I want to be invited. I want to be given the choice of whether or not I want to go. So when you talk about integration, I think it's about access, right? We want access. That didn't necessarily mean, you know, that we don't want to be able to celebrate our own culture or our own kind of, you know, we all have and seek culture and are just naturally drawn to people who are interested in the things we're interested in. So, like, I'm a huge hip-hop fan. And one of my favorite DJs, DJ Scheme in Kansas City, is a white guy, right? But we found each other because we love this music and there's a culture. So those of us who like hip hop find ourselves in the same places, whatever color we are. So it's just, I think you're just drawn to people who have a similar inclination or worldview or interest, you know?
I mean, there's that, but then there's also the systemic, you know, racist, you know, conditions that people have been subjected to.
Yeah.
And so they have to find, you know, safe spaces in order to just, you know, just be. And when you're making a choice to move, especially if you're from a, you know, underrepresented group, and you're making the choice to move in a space where you're not fully represented or you're not going to see a lot of people that, you know, look like you, then you're walking into a situation where you could be with people who, you know, you're just as, I guess, foreign to them as they are to you. And so that then makes for a challenging encounter, especially if you are the underrepresented person. And I remember I had this conversation with a white friend of mine that was talking about women and some of the challenges women collectively face. And she said to me, I wish, white and black women, we just kind of came together. And I said, well, you all have some work to do. I said, it's not that easy. And it's not going to be us caring black women, sort of working with you and carrying that burden. It's you get, fix what you need to fix to be able to be in a space with black women without, being intrusive into who we are. Just accept us for who we are without trying to change us, to make us be like you, want us to talk a certain way.
Right.
This whole notion of like civility is also this thing that comes up quite a bit. You want to have these challenging conversations, but you want them to be, done in a certain way. And so all of that takes a lot of unpacking. And so that's why, people will find the spaces where they can just talk the way they want to talk without being censored.
Let me ask you two an uncomfortable question. So I'm sure you all know the white folks who just love black people and, are very comfortable in integrated spaces, even
yes.
if most of the people around them are black. But then they also kind of like to pretend that they're black. Have you encountered that sort of language?
Oh, yeah,
in other
sure.
words, so what do you do with that?
So
if you have a white person who has been invited into your space and is clearly comfortable there, but also maybe pretends that they're not white, maybe that's a better way of putting it, and pretends that as soon as they move into that space, I'm comfortable with black people, so I'm just not white anymore. How do you... And so I hope I never convey that pretense when I'm in a predominantly black space. But I'm like, I'm white, and that's it. That's who I am. And, so how do predominantly black... I mean, this would be interesting where you went to school, when you were describing to me and blowing my mind, at HBCU, that was 80% white.
Yeah, so
that's
he talking
you
about
went to school.
Lincoln University. So there's two kind of... think strings of conversation
yes.
here, but really quickly, Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri, a historically black college, is now and was in the 80s when I attended school there,
my cousin
predominantly
there.
White. And the reason is because we're located in a rural area. They have a good agriculture program.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the students who live in Jefferson City or who are white come during the day, but they're commuter students, so they're not involved in the culture of the campus. So at night, or whenever there's a football game, or whenever there's university-related events, everybody's black.
But
so
I assume there are one or two white kids who are like
there was a young white woman who was a Delta. We call her Delta Red. She had red hair. So the Delta Sigma Theta is a sorority,
black sorority.
Black sorority. And she did, but she was very much accepted. I think the difference is, I would argue that she was raised in a black community around black people and became a part of the culture as opposed to assuming the culture or trying to pretend or use slang, to fit in. I think she was very natural in her, her use of, the way that she talked and the things that she liked to do. I think that she just was raised around black people and just picked it up. So I just think that there's a we'll call everything but the burden.
Yeah, we always say you want the rhythm but not the blues.
Yeah, you guys are giving me some inside knowledge here that I didn't have.
Exactly.
Yeah, we can usually tell when someone is authentic in their presentation.
Yeah.
And if they're not, offensive, then, because I'm also hypersensitive to this notion of what is representational of black culture. And so if someone is speaking in a particular way and thinking that they're representing black culture, I can be offended by that.
Because black culture, like every culture, is incredibly diverse.
It is very diverse.
Itself.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. And so I'm usually like, I'm thinking, well, where are they coming from?
Yeah.
And, what is it? But I'm not focused on that too much.
I don't typically find myself drawn to or wanting to interact with someone who is pretending. So
you find me authentic.
No, I find very authentic. Yeah, yeah. You know, and one of the things you'll hear black people say is, you know, he's really cool. He don't try to act black. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, you know, the black-Jewish relationship is quite different.
That's
a whole nother thing.
That's about to go seriously south.
I'm challenged. You're right. That's a whole nother thing. Right. Although James Baldwin wrote an interesting... article.
You named the topic, you wrote an interesting article. Yeah.
It was called, I'm hesitant to say it, but I found it in his archives in the Schomburg Center, an essay he wrote called Why Black People Don't Like Jewish People.
Mm.
And I was like, oh.
I'll have to go read that.
You need to go read that. Yeah, it was fascinating. But let's go to the next question. Okay. Discuss historical legacies defining race and class that are unique to this area. Ooh.
Well, we can start with the black Jewish question. Not unique to this area. It was interesting when Samson did his tour yesterday. He's leading us down Indiana Avenue. He's talking about, you know, the residential neighborhood down closer to town. And he said, well, when this area was initially settled, it was mostly Eastern European. And I poked one. I said, AKA Jewish, right? So read that question again, though. Terry.
Discuss historical legacies defining race and class that are unique to this area.
You've lived in Indy 24 years.
Yes, I don't know if I would be so inclined to discuss the historical legacy, but I know that I have heard quite a bit about the redlining and the changing infrastructure. And building like the highways through the black communities that was, you know, so disruptive.
If only that were unique.
Yes, right? And I don't know if that's unique. And then even IUPUI has this very difficult legacy of harming, Indiana Avenue and the black community just by its presence and development.
So, again, not unique, unfortunately, right?
Right.
A big urban public university. Oh, there's a nice place near town. We can lay our footprint, tear up the black neighborhood.
Right.
And this happened in almost every city
yes.
in America. So,
yeah, that's the question. The unique is.
Yeah, so unique, obviously, is not. I understand what they're saying, but it's the same everywhere you go. What I was really struck by, being from Kansas City, Missouri, on the walking tour that we took yesterday, the black part of town during segregation in Kansas City was 18th and Vine. That's where all of the black-owned businesses were. That's where Kansas City really began to develop a reputation for being an epicenter for jazz music. Neighborhood
yes.
Charlie Parker grew up in.
Just like here
right.
too, yes.
So, in the 50s and 60s, a lot of people kind of moved out of that neighborhood, started to decline. Then, you know, in terms of the broader black community at that time, built Highway 71 right through the black community, bought a lot of people out, displaced a lot of people. You know, he was talking about the YMCA and how important that was to this neighborhood in Kansas City.
We had
City,
that here, too.
The
yes.
YMCA was where the Negro League actually started. So all of these similarities
right.
were really striking to me. But as Alex was saying, and as you kind of intimated, anywhere you go, there's going to be a very similar story about how the black community has been impacted through infrastructure and all of these other divestment and all of these things.
So let me put on my
yes.
hat as an oral historian for a minute. So, Terry, yeah. you said you grew up in Richmond, California.
Yes.
That has a unique history.
It does,
right? Which
yes.
I know a little bit about, but I'd be curious. So Richmond is a place which, you know, had 10,000 people in 1940, and in 1943 it had 100,000 people because of the shipyards for the war.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those people were black. I don't remember the percentage. But
yeah.
you had people from Oklahoma, white people from Oklahoma, and black people from Louisiana and Arkansas,
yeah.
all moving into this community, which
yeah.
held 10,000 people, and overnight it had 100,000 people.
Yeah.
No room on the streetcars, no housing, everyone working together in the shipyards. This is a racially explosive community. So that's
yeah.
the history I know from the 40s, but you grew up there. So
yeah, I wasn't there
the
in
legacy.
The 40s. But
what was the legacy of that?
My family migrated from Natchitoches, Louisiana, to California, to Oakland. Yeah, exactly. And Richmond. And so
Right after that. Right when they were laying all the platforms.
It was right after that, yeah. And actually there's
That's how Huey Newton got there too, by the way.
Right. So Newtons came from the same location mm-hmm. in Louisiana as my family. My mother went to McClimates High School with the Newton family. And actually their parents started the Antioch Baptist Church along with my grandfather, Rafe Taylor. So yeah, we know the Newtons. But there's a picture, I think Langston Hughes did it. Not Langston Hughes, it was...
Dorothea Lange.
No, it's an exhibit.
Oh, what's here.
I was thinking about the Langston Hughes poem, but it's of a migration. It's
of Jacob Lawrence.
Jacob Lawrence, yeah, exactly.
And there were lynchings.
And there's lynchings, and it made me think of a story my grandfather told for StoryCorps, where he said... my cousin was interviewing him and asked him why he left Louisiana, and he talked about how he was walking down the street and he saw his cousin, and then the next hour or so he saw his cousin floating down the river. And so he and my grandfather was part of a very large family, 15, 16 brothers and sisters. They all moved from Louisiana to Oakland, California. I have a very extensive family in the Bay Area.
But carrying that historical
trauma. But discover that California was not all that much better than Louisiana. So they did have some opportunities. My grandmother worked for Clorox. But we celebrated, carrying also the culture and the celebration. So in Richmond, we had huge Juneteenth celebrations happening. And so when that became this, sort of recognition type thing, I was like, we've been celebrating that. Because it was Texas, Louisiana, all coming to the West, and bringing that. But then also ultimately assuming leadership positions, especially in Richmond. And so I would say that the racialized legacy, I guess, would be still the housing, and which ties to education. I mean, that's where these legacies kind of unfold, is to where people were living. I was living in a predominantly black neighborhood in Richmond. Now, I was bused to school to Kensington. Which is a predominantly white community in the Berkeley Hills. And so that's where things become a little more disruptive when we think about sort of, going back to the other question, like segregation, and because even though we might have these housing and living neighborhood arrangements, there's still other ways that we have to interact and live together. And when it came to the educational, public education, that was one way that, this whole integration thing happening was really about moving black children out of their neighborhoods into white schools, but not necessarily to live there. They went to school there and I bus right back down to my own community. And so, but that's not, busing was an issue here too in Indianapolis. And it was late. And people don't realize how late these policies were unfolding in the 70s and 80s. And so when we talk about historical legacy, we're still living these legacies and these defining moments of, particularly when we talk about black-white dynamics. Now, when we talk about other, various racial and ethnic groups, then it becomes even a little more, nuanced and complex.
I mean, that's what I liked about this walking tour we were on so much, is that he took the long view, right? And he said, okay, you have to understand how this neighborhood became this cultural and commercial hub of black life, mm-hmm. and tied it precisely to the first great migration during World War I and the second great migration mm-hmm. during World War II, and the YMCA being this crucial institution of integration, not racial integration, but community integration, as black folks came up here from Mississippi, probably.
Right.
And landed at the foot of Indiana Avenue and mm-hmm. looked around, like, where am I going to go to get help finding housing and a job? But they're going to the YMCA, which is right there, and the Madam Walker Theater and all that,
yes.
right? So and then, of course, as you were describing, Terry, and in Kansas City too, those neighbors, and someone described it yesterday at the Madam Walker event we went to, then there's disinvestment.
Oh,
right?
The
city starts disinvesting.
That's right.
Companies move away. White banks, people move away.
Yes.
Banks move away. Grocery stores move away.
Right.
And suddenly, you know, oh, it's a slum. And then it's a slum, quote unquote. And then it's time to build the highway, the hospital, and the university. Oh, yeah, we're going to, you know, revitalize the inner city. Let's build these institutions.
Yes.
Destroying the remainder of the black neighborhood. And then it becomes, you know, sort of a desert. Nobody walking around, no grocery stores, no residences. And then everyone, a generation later, forgets why that is. And they're like, oh, wait, look at all that great real estate lying around there.
That's
we've got to
right.
get the developers all over that. And then, as Samson said, and then you hire an outside firm to come do some redevelopment, as if there wasn't a historical legacy for the reason this neighborhood seems to be empty.
Yeah.
Magically empty.
Right.
This is why I'm a historian. So we need monuments to those, but how do you monumentalize that sort of long durée transformation? I don't know the answer to that, but
yeah, I mean, but we need reparations, you know.
Well,
I mean,
might
it's
be
not
the
answer. Monuments, you know. It's where's the revitalization? You know, where are those dollars
meanwhile,
going?
Meanwhile, we're talking about this, and I have to say this. I hope other tables are saying this. There's a very interesting sort of struggle brewing here, where there's a massive, maybe you know more about this than I do, Terry. Massive commercial redevelopment of a plot of land on the White River, which runs through central Indianapolis, which happens to be sitting on top of an African-American cemetery for the 19th century.
Oh, I don't know.
And so
yeah,
there are people in this community now trying to say, you know what, before you dig that up, let's figure out who's buried there, or what's buried there, how many people were there. Let's, you know, let's monumentalize this. Let's memorialize this. Let's not just pave it over. So I don't know how that's going to go, but that's going to be a big, big issue.
Well, there's also the communities on the south side of Indianapolis that were established by colored Union troops.
Mm.
And those were some of the troops that were called up that ended up in Galveston.
I didn't
know that. And were largely responsible for notifying the enslaved people there that they were free. Kayla Austin has actually done a lot of research and history on that. I'll have to send you the video.
Kayla should be here this afternoon.
Oh, yeah, she'll talk about
so
that.
I
yeah.
I hope someone will ask her that question.
Yeah, she can talk all about that.
Are you going to be here this afternoon?
No, I will not.
Glenn, you are, so you tell Kayla to talk about that.
Oh, yes.
This afternoon's black only, so it's not going to be
well,
me.
I'm not an artist.
I mean, like, the artist is, yeah, I know it's the black table and it's a black organization.
No, the artist is black.
Gotcha,
and
gotcha.
I'm not an artist either.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
No,
you're an artist.
I'm something.
You're an artist. I'm not an artist.
One last question. Blank.
Oh, it's a blank one.
Terry, I hate to put you on the spot, but you're the only person who knows Indianapolis. Indianapolis-centric.
Well, you know, I am always curious about the approach to violence, especially that is coming from our youth, black youth, you know, unfortunately, and from many different directions. And I interpret violence in a lot of different ways. And I feel that our youth are being violently harmed in, you know, the educational process. I hate to keep harping on that, but I feel like there is something there that then is pushing them to be very frustrated and have all of this anger, and then to unfortunately explode against one another because they are isolated in, you know, these communities. Who else are they going to?
Right. The nearest target is the people.
Yeah,
that
people
they
live with. Right. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, my question is, how do we? And I've been thinking a lot about this. How do we use our history, our humanities, and our arts to recapture our young people so that they can be more empowered to, you know, they need to all be in here, you know. I mean, if they were here.
Here, meaning the Christmas
in the
Attics.
Christmas Attics, yeah, in the museum, and really seeing, you know, and meeting people like Lynn, you know, like really understanding their history and where they come from, the resilience of their people. You know, how do we get that to be a vehicle for them to handle conflict in a different way? And I relate to their anger.
In Indy, okay.
A huge problem.
Yeah.
It's a huge problem. It's heartbreaking every time. You know, I try not to watch the news too much, but every time I turn on the TV, it's some young black, you know, person, and it's not just men and women, who, you know, have unfortunately been killed. And I've been
thinking. By the police, by one another?
By one another. some by the police too, but yeah, largely by one another. And I've been thinking about what is the foundation and source of that, and thinking that the answer is the arts and the humanities, which has been largely stripped out of their educational process.
So you took the words right out of my mouth. I was at a conference, it's called the International Institute for Restorative Practices. I gave my job title, but in most museums it would be the director of education.
Yeah.
And so I've been doing museum education for a while, and I do believe and agree with you that arts and culture are critical, because it really helps young people understand who they are. Mm-hmm. It gives them an outlet. It is not necessarily, you know, so I do a lot of poetry programming with young people, and I've seen it be transformative.
Yes.
But I also know that there are sometimes students who need additional help. Like, poetry can be therapeutic.
Right.
It's not therapy. Right?
Yes, right. Yes, that's right. That's real.
Is look at what those students are writing about, then you can identify what other support they may need, and you can offer that help or connect them with the people who can. So, but at the conference is what I was trying to say. They were talking about moving outside of systems. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And finding grassroots approaches to deal with some of the issues. And things that we know would be helpful, but the system doesn't seem to be interested in. And so for the past couple of weeks, I've been thinking about, like, how do you create spaces outside of a school where the kids can really learn about art or learn more about their culture, because that will instill more of a sense of self-esteem. And hopefully give them a stronger sense of empathy, so that they're not, you know, as you say, exploding on it.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem for, I think, for well-meaning white folks, liberal and leftist white folks, is we are afraid to say what you just said. That is, you know, we are reluctant to say, you know, one of the problems, of course, is police violence against people of color. None of us are reluctant to say that.
Right.
But there's a strong reluctance to say, but, you know, another problem is violence against
one another. Right.
Especially amongst youth.
I mean,
look around, you see it. But you don't, as a white person, you don't want to say that, because that's taken as, with some reason, as blaming the victim. And especially since we know that the racist forces in this country, that's the first place they go. Oh, stop talking about police violence. Black on black crime is what it's all about.
Right.
So that makes it hard.
I hate it too. Because it's about the system.
But you know that's what the right wing says.
Sure, sure.
Right.
So that makes liberal and lefty whites reluctant to address that issue, because we don't want to be lumped with the people and say, oh man, it's all about black on black crime. Stop talking about the police.
Right.
Which is a despicable position.
But it, you know, crime, you commit crimes to those who you're approximate to.
Yeah.
And we know that the poverty, you know what I mean? There are other things other than just being a black person. But the implication that black people are inherently more violent than other cultures is what's kind of the subtext.
Yes, that's right.
And that's what really bothers me.
Well,
me too.
As it should. Yeah. I mean, this is why white people, you know better, are reluctant to say that.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, we can have the conversations, but we do have to talk about the institutions and the structures that are feeding and informing and creating.
The school.
The schools,
the prison or the juvenile justice system.
Right, exactly. All these systems,
you know,
the lack of parks and recreation, you know, the stripping away of these artistic programs in schools, you know, it's...
The channeling of people into the criminal justice system.
Yeah, absolutely.
Readily, which then has, you know, knockoff effects in terms of employment, in terms of all sorts of things, in terms of violence.
Yeah, but even participation in society, voting, you know, all of that is tied to that.
Tough questions.
Good questions.
Anything
to
add,
about.
Or shall table three sign off?
I think we can sign off. Right. I have nothing to add. None of us are actually native people
Place. Well, yeah, come on, sir. I say I'm from Miami because I lived in Miami 20 years.
I always say I'm from California. Right, I mean, I have, but I leave here a lot. You know, I mean.
You know this better than Glenn and I do. So this has been great because I know Glenn. I know some of Glenn's stories. We've talked, but Terry, I've not met you. It's really great. I learned a lot about Indianapolis.
I will say though, my relationship with you. This is I've been in Bloomington twice. This is my first time in Indianapolis, but I feel especially like last night we went to the Madam C.J. Walker Legacy Center for the unveiling.
Yeah.
Is it Madam C.J. Walker Way?
Avenue.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And so then there was a reception. So I met one of your colleagues who's at Purdue.
Matt.
Yeah,
Joseph.
Matt.
Yes.
And so I've met some really cool people since I've been here. And it sounds like there's conversations about me coming back. And
definitely.
For sure.
Parallels between Indianapolis and Bloomington.
Because you started out with sort of the 18th and Vine District.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a revitalization effort around something that's very similar.
I started
to Indiana
hosting
Avenue.
Poetry reading there when there was the talk about we're going to revitalize the 18th and Vine area. I had been thinking about hosting a poetry reading. And I said, well, let me do it there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's going to be up and coming.
How long ago was that?
That was in 97.
So, has it worked? Has it been revitalized?
It is better than it was, but it's still
so all these great dreams of the Walker Center and the mayor were laying out there last night where you
No, I wish them the best. I hope.
But you heard the same speeches 25 years
absolutely,
ago, right?
Absolutely.
Is there a white mayor of Kansas City there?
No.
And there's an election happening for
a
mayor here.
Yeah.
The Hogsett's heart seems to be in the right place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was there.
I can't say anything negative about him because I'm appointed by him to the Bombay Board. So I'm a mayoral appointee.
Well,
so, yes, he's an excellent mayor.
So you heard that. But I assume you were sitting there thinking, I heard all these exact same speeches 25 years ago.
I was.
18th
I was,
and 9.
I was.
So has it been a successful redevelopment project?
I would have to say semi-successful. I don't want to knock the efforts of people who have had businesses. You know, we've got the American Jazz Museum, we've got the Negro League Baseball Museum, they're revitalizing the YMCA, it's going to be the Buck O'Neill Center for Research, so people can come and learn more about the history of the Negro Leagues and kind of use that as a lens to study race relations in America.
That's very exciting.
You've got the Black Archives there that's been newly refurbished and reopened like in 2013.
But you haven't mentioned a single commercial
thing yet. We've got a few restaurants that are in the area.
That's important.
Yeah.
Entrepreneurship,
But it just hasn't popped. You know what I mean? It hasn't all come together.
But you know what
way.
Has? Montgomery. Yeah. So you've been to Montgomery. Right?
Yeah.
That is totally true. So I went to Montgomery 35 years ago to do dissertation research.
Yeah.
There was nothing in downtown Montgomery.
Oh.
It had been completely abandoned.
Yeah.
It was just the state capitol.
So I'm sorry. I was just going to say.
Go ahead.
So the Kansas City Power and Lighter, which is truly downtown, it was desolate. And about 15 or so years ago, they said, we're going to revitalize downtown. And it was done. You know what I mean? I'm saying, but it's very white is what I'm trying to get.
But Montgomery not so. In other words, Montgomery's been revitalized by Brian Stevenson and the Legacy Center.
Sure.
And who's coming to spend money in the restaurants and hotels and bars there?
Yeah.
It's a lot of African Americans
coming
on tours to the memorial and the Legacy Museum.
Yeah, absolutely.
But my point was that when the city decided to get behind that.
Yep.
It happened.
Well, that was Samson's point. This is what's happened
but the
a mile to the east.
I think also here that there's the Central Indiana Community Foundation has done a great job in cultivating black philanthropy dollars.
Yeah.
And that's so there's a large, a movement happening here with that. And so, you know, with Gang Gang and with that whole sort of art celebration.
We'll see if they cover that.
Yeah.
What is Gang Gang?
Oh, Gang Gang is just...
of that slang. I hear from
they're arts entrepreneurs, right?
I would say it's an organization that has been Malia Jeffries and Alan Bacon very instrumental in bringing black art, visual art especially, into kind of the high art arena, but making it accessible.
Yeah.
And so they've done these really fantastic celebrations called Butter. And It's like this over, I want to say Labor Day weekend. It's like a kind of an elaborate celebration. They have a warehouse.
It's in the Stutz building, exhibits. Right?
Yeah, the Stutz building. And they really showcase all of these, I think almost half are local black artists.
Some of whom I hope will be here this afternoon.
Yeah, and so they can talk a lot about how amazing it is. And I actually found an artist through kind of the art fair who then I hired to do a mural in my space at Butler.
Okay, wonderful.
Who was that?
Sade Bell. Shady the Art Lady. She has murals all over.
She's in D.C. I don't know her, but again, I went through the list of all the Butter people, and that's how I identified her.
She lives in D.C. now, but she has murals all over the community, and she's young, self-taught, amazing. So I had her do a mural in my suite, in my space that I have.
Getting you introduced to the artist table.
Awesome. Perfect
Butter
little intro happening.
So yeah.
We're going to mix up the questions a little bit in the second session, so if you're staying.
I am not.
Okay.
I'm not an artist, so I wouldn't dare. I would be totally intimidated if I was sitting at a table with artists.
Are you here yet?
No, we put a little time in between the two, so we have some time to turn over tables and everything.
All right, so we're done?
Yeah, I just have to add something to your recording.
Let me sort of figure out how long
I think it's still recording.
Yeah.
It is, but it should be. That number seems wrong.
Why don't we just do that then?
All right.
Oh, 50. I'm reading upside down, child.
Okay.
Yes, I need to add some information. This is Keandra Bills Freeman reporting from People's Table Number 3 on October 21st, 2023 at Crispus Attucks Museum.